I'd like to first start by acknowledging my co-authors. Mary Parr is one of my graduate students, and Tanwali Gigi, is what we call her, 601, postdoc who worked in my lab on this project. Sarah Seehaver is my lab manager and technician, and Chris Freeberg-Horton, an excellent colleague of mine in the crop science department at NC State. So nitrogen fixation is arguably one of the most important processes that we have in organic agriculture, primarily because it represents one of the major sources of new nitrogen entering the system. So we're starting to understand a lot of factors that are controlling nitrogen fixation and controlling the amount of nitrogen that's actually reaching organic crop plants through this mutualism. But primarily, the one piece that we really don't yet understand is the relationship between the rhizobia that are dwelling in the soil, that are part of this mutualism, and the plants that they're nodulating, which are the legumes in the legume family. So through this symbiosis, of course, the mutualism is such that the rhizobia are giving the legume nitrogen, fixed nitrogen from the atmosphere, and the plant is giving the rhizobia carbon. But the catch is that in some cases, if the rhizobia in some strains or subspecies of rhizobia that enter the nodule have been shown to be less effective in giving that crop plant nitrogen. So we might have varying amounts of nitrogen that is given to the crop plant that then exists to be released to non-legume plants in the organic system. So that's where we enter in. We look at, my lab looks at multiple points in this nitrogen release that you see up here through the legume. But in the last couple years, we've become primarily interested in looking at rhizobia ecology and how that relationship works in organic systems and what the controls are in organic systems that might modify how much nitrogen is getting into the legume. And that's what I'm going to talk about today by presenting some preliminary data that we've gathered on hairy vetch, one cover crop that we've heard a lot about today. If you were in the previous session, you heard hairy vetch mentioned a lot. These are some images of cover crops, winter annual cover crops that are used in the southeast. And in the upper left-hand corner, you'll see some images of vetch. And in particular, we're interested in looking at differences between vetch populations that are different genetically or in the way they perform in the field. And we're looking at four different populations of vetch. Two which were bred at Auburn University. One's called Early Cover, and the other is called Merit. And we're also looking at a variant of this Early Cover population that's been worked with or bred, kind of self-bred by a grower in Pennsylvania who bred it to be winter hardy. So we call that the winter hardy Early Cover. We also have an experimental population, which actually isn't experimental anymore. It's now been released, bred by Tom Devine, who you see here in the picture at USDA, called Purple Prosperity. And it's also an early flowering variety of vetch, so designed to be part of these systems where we want them to flower earlier so we can have successful roll kill in the field. So inoculation. Inoculation is the process through which farmers introduce a type of rhizobia that's shown to be effective with the legume in question in the field. So they apply it to the seed at planting, and it goes into the field, and in many cases, it's assumed to be who is getting into the nodule. In a recent survey of 180 growers that was conducted by a graduate student at NC State, Suzanne O'Connell, she found that it wasn't always the case that farmers were inoculating on a regular basis. She found that about 46% were using inoculants on their legume cover crops regularly, 32% said they just didn't use them at all, and then 16% chose to use inoculants only when they were inoculating a new legume into the system, okay, with the assumption that maybe the right bacteria wasn't there in the soil that they needed for that nodulation to take place. So rhizobia that you have in the soil are either from an inoculant strain that you've introduced, or they can be from indigenous or naturalized populations, which here I'm also going to refer to as native, that are already existing in the soil. So they might be in the soil from previous inoculants. They might be a strain of rhizobia that are able to nodulate a native type of vetch in this case. But these native rhizobia can be beneficial if they're fixing large amounts of nitrogen, but they can also be problematic if they're competing with the inoculant strain that's shown to be effective in the soil and less effective in nitrogen fixation. So the rhizobia we're going to be talking about today is Rhizobium leguminosarum, and Vissier is the tribe that is shown to nodulate vetch along with peas and lentils. So this, I should add, this, a lot of this research was conducted as a side project of one of my graduate students, Mary Parr. Her graduate project had what we call scope creep, where it got bigger and bigger and bigger. And this was some really interesting, we got through one of her extra projects. But primarily, we were interested in learning how diversity of the native populations of rhizobium leguminosarum varied across the state. We also wanted to know how effective inoculation was. When we were inoculating these vetches, was that who was ending up in the nodule? And finally, looking at these four populations I talked about in previous slides, we wanted to know if different vetch varieties were occupied by different types of rhizobia. So we had three sites across the state that we looked at in this experiment. We had one in what I'll call Piedmont, Cephs, and Tidewater, three very different soil types. Our field design was a randomized complete block design. We had four blocks with each of them containing a treatment that included planted and inoculated vetches. So one, AU Merit, Early Cover, Purple Prosperity, and the Winter Hardy Early Cover. And again, these were all inoculated. So what we did was we took nodules about 4 months after growth from the inoculated vetches and compared them to rhizobia that we trapped using soils from the uninoculated margins around the field. So the trapping was done and the rhizobia isolation was done in the lab, but we had to get the rhizobia in different ways because, of course, we had to get them from this from the native soil as well as from the nodules that had been grown on the plants that were inoculated. We also isolated rhizobia from the commercial inoculant that was used to inoculate the vetches that were in the field. Okay, some pictures of how this was done. We grew these each of the vetch types in what we called magenta units, little pots that were controlled for nitrogen, so that they could trap the rhizobia that were found in those soils taken from our three field sites. And that was done in a growth chamber. And then from both of the vetch types that were either grown in the trapped rhizobia environments or in the field, we took the nodules off, surface sterilized them, and then looked at the genetic makeup of the rhizobia that were present in those nodules using two techniques. And the two techniques we used were looking at the NIFH gene, which is a gene that codes for an enzyme that's necessary to carry out nitrogen fixation, and then we followed that up with digestion with two restriction enzymes. And secondly, we used a very tried and true technique for this kind of analysis called RET-PCR. And RET-PCR looks at some differences in some repetitive elements that are found within the genome of rhizobia. And so this allows us to compare to other studies that have done similar work who have also used this RET-PCR analysis. What you get is an image that looks something like this. This is not from our experiment, but each of these lanes you see here is a different rhizobia type isolated from a nodule. So if you get similar banding patterns, you can draw the conclusion that the strains that show very similar bands, much like a barcode, are similar in their genetic makeup. Images that you get using this technique, this RET-PCR technique, can then be analyzed using a very powerful software tool called BioNumerics that allows us to cluster and sort the different banding patterns, allowing us to show which of the strains are similar and which are different. And I'll show you a picture of what that looks like in a second. Well, the first thing we noticed when we harvested the plants from the growth chamber, so we were looking at those, again, the trapped rhizobia from the native soils, was that we did not see any differences in nodule number among the different populations of vetch, but we did see differences, significant differences, in the number of nodules that formed among sites, with Tidewater showing significantly fewer nodules growing all the vetch types. So when looking at the molecular evaluation of the strains, the first analysis, with looking at the variation in this NIFH gene, told us that in two of our sites, the Tidewater and Piedmont, we had fairly similar suites of bacteria in each of those sites. We have, if you see on the right here, these five different banding patterns. Those were what were identified as the banding patterns across all three sites. So Piedmont and Tidewater, very similar numbers of each of those banding patterns at each site, with both of them containing predominantly this number one banding pattern. Then we had a third site that really varied quite significantly in the strains that were present, with most of the strains at that site coming from the second banding pattern here in number two. So that was our first clue that we were going to find some differences amongst in the RET-PCR values as well. So we're going to spend some time on this. This is a typical image that you would get from the software package Bionumerics, showing us that how similar or different strains are when compared to each other in and amongst all the field sites. So the first thing, well, let me explain how we look at this first, so those of you that might not be familiar with looking at this kind of image. These are the gel lanes that have been broken up and reorganized in such a way that we can compare and similarities amongst the strains. And the closer that these branches form to the right, the more similar these strains are to each other. So we can then look at what we call clusters that form. And so each of the clusters here are recognized with one of those bars in the side. And what we found was that, probably the most important thing, was that the inoculant rhizobia looked nothing like any of the strains that we saw in the inoculated plants in the field or in the field margins where native rhizobia were trapped. Second thing we found was that in two of the sites, Piedmont and Tidewater, the native rhizobia looked pretty similar to one another. They were about 85% similar in terms of their genetics. So they formed one big cluster. But the inoculated plants from each of those sites formed their own smaller cluster. So they were, the inoculated plants did not look like the inoculant that we put on them, but nor did it look like the background rhizobia that were present in those field margins. Finally, we found that our third site, the one that looked so distinctly and different from the first two sites, was that the CEPH site, was that the native and the inoculated plant rhizobia looked very, very similar to each other and were only a slight bit similar to the other sites. So telling us that probably at this site, the CEPH site, that the inoculant didn't look like it was working, but what was getting into the nodule were the native strains that were at that site, which were very different from the other two sites. So I'm going to tell you about another a mini study that we've just started after this, but in conclusion to this study, we found that these two sites contained very genetically similar native rhizobia. But at these same two sites, we found pretty significant genetic distinctions between the rhizobia that were occupying the inoculated plant nodules and these native nodules in the field margins. This Goldsboro CEPH site, where I refer to here, included one single cluster that included inoculated plant rhizobia and the native rhizobia. And none of these sites was an exact match to the rhizobia that we had put on all the sites. So, and again, no vetch population preferences were shown for these specific genotypes. So, the big question here is, well, what does this mean for organic growers? Well, again, this is preliminary work, so we're still getting to it, to a conclusion, but we're starting to question, in some cases, whether it's worth it for farmers to go through the labor of inoculation of their legumes. The inoculant itself is cheap, as we saw in the previous slide. It's, you know, $1, $2. But the labor that is expended to put the inoculant on the seed can be significant. And we're doing some research right now and survey work trying to figure out what that labor is. So what do farmers actually do to put the inoculant on the seed and care for the inoculant before it goes on the seed to make sure it's viable? Could be that the inoculants that are going on are not viable by the time they go out to the field. Maybe they've sat on the dashboard of the truck for, you know, too many months. But finally, one of the things we're hypothesizing is that there might be some management techniques or management options that farmers are using that are modifying that native population that's present in the soil. And so we have a graduate student right now, Napi Mothapo, who has started a project last year looking at how past history of hairy vetch cultivation will influence what bacteria is in the soil, what rhizobia are in the soil. Does having vetch in the field change that native population and influence who ends up in the nodule if you don't inoculate at all? So just really quickly, what... Okay, I'll show you this last slide. it's good. I said I'd do this if I had time. So what we're seeing here are one slide on the left showing a history of hairy vetch cultivation, and a slide on the right showing a plot that's immediately adjacent to that first slide with no hairy vetch history. And then you can see here, which is a teaser, there's some pretty big differences between the plot that had hairy vetch planted in the past and the plot that does not have hairy vetch. So more to come. I'll keep you on the edge of your seats waiting for this research to come out. But again, thanks everybody. This is my lab group and contact information. Thank you.